Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
Live from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, in the foothills of the majestic Rocky Mountains, welcome to Alberta's Rocky Mountain salute to the 15th Olympic Winter Games. Ladies and gentlemen, the Calgary Stampede Show Band.
Well, if we're going to talk about the 88 Winter Olympic Games, we have to welcome to the show Michael Eddie the Eagle Edwards. Hello.
Hello.
Do you go by Michael or Eddie? Why? Eddie. How does your world work? Eddie to everyone.
Yeah, always Eddie. I only use Michael for my plastering.
Which is the job still?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I still do my plastering.
Wow. And still enjoy it and that takes up most of your time?
No. PR and doing speeches and after-dinner speaking, motivational talks, TV, radio, all that kind of thing. That takes me all over the world and it takes up a lot of my time at the moment. But when things start to slow down, I'll go back to my plastering and I still enjoy that just as much.
And so when you say when that slows down, is this on the back of the film coming out a couple of years ago? Is it all kicked off again or what's prompted all this?
Yeah, well, I've always been pretty busy doing my PR work, but since the movie that was released in April 16, I've been phenomenally busy, so busy that I had to give up all my plastering and things because I was just busy every single day doing PR work and it's pretty much the same at the moment, and it will be probably for this year, and then hopefully next year if things start to slow down a little bit I can then introduce a little bit more plastering, but who knows.
Wow, that's extraordinary, isn't it? 30 years later.
Yeah, I can't believe it. I'm still talking about my life, that you know, and that moment at Calgary that happened 30 years ago. But it is nice. It's nice to know that people still remember me very fondly, and it's nice that it had such an impact that 30 years later people still remember.
And Eddie, do you dread having to go back to the plastering and I guess the attention, the fame dissipating again?
Actually, I enjoy both sides because the PR work is great fun and I travel all over the world, meet lots of interesting people, do lots of interesting things, and I'm talking about my, you know, that event that happened 30 years ago. Mm. But I also like doing my plastering when I'm just Michael Edwards. It's just me in my radio. I'm plastering a wall or somebody's ceiling and it's just me on my own, and I like that too. So sort of the one complements the other.
Mm. So if we touch on your story, there's lots of fascinating aspects to it I hadn't been aware of, because invariably, and it's true for a lot of people in the limelight, the caricature is what tends to stick and people misremember lots of details. And, you know, I'm sure you're more aware of that than anybody. So born in Cheltenham, not rich, like you did not come about, you did not come to the sport because your family were off in the Alps every winter.
No. My dad was a builder and plasterer. My mum worked in an office. We weren't rich by any stretch. And also, I've got an older brother and a younger sister, so they had to treat us all more or less equally. I started on a school ski trip. I skied at Gloucester Ski Centre. I got a job there, so my mum and dad didn't have to pay for me to ski all the time. And that's what I used. That became my home. If I wasn't at school, I'd be over at Gloucester Ski Centre skiing away, and that made it easier working there and not having to pay to go skiing.
And what was it about skiing in Gloucester that did it for you?
Skiing just ticked all my boxes because I loved all sports when I was a child. I did athletics for the school, I played football for the school, I did rugby, cricket, I did tennis, squash, badminton, kung fu, karate, judo, volleyball, all kinds of sport. I loved doing all sport, but when I started skiing, that was the sport that ticked all my boxes. It was fun, it was exciting, it was very individual. I could be as good as I wanted to be, it was totally up to me. That's what I stuck with.
Yeah, because I guess that might be one of the first misnomers that I had about you, which is that maybe, well, it's a terrible term to use, but that you were in some way talentless from a sporting point of view, that, you know, they're completely uncoordinated and, you know, shouldn't have been anywhere near any kind of elite level sport. But actually, I mean, you were big into your skiing to the point that before you went down the ski jumping route, as a downhill skier, as you were trying to qualify for the 84 Winter Games, you were the ninth fastest amateur in the world. You skied at a speed of 171.9 kilometres per hour.
That's right.
Now, I mean, we've all been in a car, and, you know, I drive a motorbike, and I've never got close to 171.9, but I have an appreciation for what that kind of wind into your face would feel like. I mean, that is phenomenal.
Yeah, when I left school at 17, I got a job in Italy working as a ski mechanic, and I did all my racing over there. I did slalom, super G, downhill, speed skiing, and also I still did my jumps as well. I used to jump on my alpine skis. I jumped over snow cats and jumped over buses and jumped over people. I was just so into my skiing, and not many people realised that I was actually a very, very good skier. I raced internationally and things like that, which, you know, didn't really come across 30 years ago.
No, I mean, 30 years ago you were some dude who found out maybe you could get there as the only Briton and wandered in off the street. That was kind of, deal.
That's right. It was almost like that. The week before Calgary, well, have a go at ski jumping. That can't be difficult. And off I go. But no, it was kind of like that, because when I was at Calgary, I'd been jumping for 20 months. Mm. Everybody else, though, had been jumping for over 25 years. So I was still very, very much a beginner, which is what they really captured in the movie. They said it was my first, very first jump. Now, it wasn't my very first, but I'd only done about five jumps off the 120-meter ski jump. So I was like a beginner, because everybody else had done about 30,000 jumps off it. So they did pick that right really well. But yes, I was very much a beginner when I was doing my ski jumping.
Yeah, so true in relative terms, if not quite literal terms.
Yes, that's
so
right.
I'm even amazed that there was a slope in Gloucester, this indoor ski slope in Gloucester. Or was it outdoor?
Yeah, it's an outdoor. It's outdoor. A dry ski slope. The nearest indoor ski slope, because they didn't come along until 92. The first one we had was in Tamworth, and now we've got about six around the country. Right. But yeah, Gloucester was a dry ski slope.
Okay, and was it particularly popular?
It was back then. Every night, during the winter, it was great. There were lots of people there. The army and navy and forces, they used to come up and ski there once a week, and lots of ski clubs from all over, like Oxford and South West and South Wales, they used to come up to Gloucester. So it's a very, very popular ski slope.
Mm. So we mentioned your downhill skiing, the ninth fastest amateur time in the world, speed in the world, 172 kilometers per hour, effectively. So you didn't make the 84 games. That part is true. And is there sometime between 84 and 88, it strikes you that there isn't a huge amount of depth in the ski jumping category, and you decide to target that? Or how exactly did that come about, Eddie?
Well, I fell into jumping really by accident, because I'd been training in Europe, but it was very, very expensive. So I did another year or two racing around Europe, but then I decided to go to America, because I thought the cost of living would be cheaper in America and it would be easier for me to carry on my ski racing. And then I went to Lake Placid in upstate New York, but which turned out to be just as expensive, if not more expensive than Europe. So I ran out of money again. And it was a question of either, you know, going back home, back to Cheltenham, and going back to plastering and forgetting about skiing, or try and find something cheaper to do, and ski jumping was cheaper. So it was an economic decision, really. And right. And then I knew that, well, then I realized that Britain have never had a jumper before, and I thought, well, I'll go with it and see what happens. And then 20 months later, off I went to Calgary.
Tell us about those 20 months.
They were exciting, very, very scary, and painful as well, because I had quite a few falls and hurt myself quite a few times. But
what does hurting yourself quite a few times entail?
Oh, well, I fractured my skull twice. I broke my jaw, broke my collarbone, smashed my collarbone, broke three ribs, damaged my kidney, damaged my knee, and damaged my ribs, and all sorts of stuff. So,
is there no way to get good without doing all that, no?
Sorry?
Is there no way to get good without breaking all those bones and fracturing your skull?
The thing is that you've got to push yourself. It's very easy in ski jumping to stay within your comfort zone, but then you'll only be an average ski jumper. And I needed to get very good very quickly, and I needed to get up to the big jumps as quickly as I could, so that I could do the European Cup and all that kind of thing, and then hopefully qualify for Calgary. So I did take enormous risks. You know, most jumpers don't really get on a 90 meter until at least 8, 9, 10 years, and I did it after about 10 months.
Okay, and who's teaching you? I mean, who's guiding you through this voyage of madness?
Well, whoever was around at the time. When I was in Lake Placid, there was a guy called John Viscomi. He was an Italian New Yorker, and he was an ex-ski jumper himself. Mm. And he used to come in his pickup truck and watch me jump on the 10-metre, the 15-metre and the 40-metre, and he used to give me bits of advice. And then I went from there, and then I went to Switzerland, and I trained with the French team and the Italian team and the Dutch team and the Spanish team, and just got a bit of coaching wherever I was, wherever I could get it, whether it was a school team, a regional team, or a national team.
You mentioned the 90-metre jump, ultimately, which is what you did at the 88 Games, and the 70-metre as well. So say you're going from a 10-metre jump to 20-metre to, you mentioned, 40-metre there. The technique, I presume, is largely similar, but where does fear come into it? When you first look down the barrel of a 40-metre jump, like, does your brain say, don't do this?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. You know, everything in your body, every pore in your body is telling you not to do this. And you've just got to overcome that and override it and say, no, I am going to do this and I am going to be okay. And it did. Fear didn't really start kicking in until I got to the 40 meter, because that was a big jump. You know, you're about 150 feet from top to bottom. And you know that if you make a mistake, it's going to hurt.
I was going to say, that is probably the point where your brain says this is now life threatening. And that's why it kicks in. It's an evolutionary mechanism to try and keep you alive.
That's right. I mean, my body was shaking and all, but I always knew I had enough about me to be able to land on my feet. And I thought, if I fall over after that, it doesn't matter. So long as I can land on my feet, that was the most important thing. And then when I did a jump, I thought, well, actually, that wasn't as scary as I thought it was. So sometimes it's more of a perceived, you know, you think it's going to be really, really horrible and really dangerous. And when you've done it, you think, oh, actually, that wasn't so bad. And so, you know, I use that as well.
You said you fractured your skull twice.
Yes.
I mean, I kind of figure you fracture your skull once and you're done. And I figure you fracture your skull twice, you're definitely done. You don't want to do that a third time. Like, how are you fracturing your skull? What kind of height to jump? Or how is that happening?
Well, it's just if you're unlucky enough, when you take off, because you're only attached, back then you were only attached to your skis by your toes, so you could make a mistake, and then all of a sudden you've got these great big skis, and you don't know whether that's you're going to release or not, and sometimes you came down and you either landed on your head or your face or your chest or your back or your feet, and occasionally I landed just in a very awkward position and hit the back of my neck and the top of my skull, and that's where it fractures, because the helmet is, you know, it protects you, but it doesn't guarantee that it'll stop you from fracturing your skull. You know, you can't always rely on a helmet.
This is a question I've never asked before. Do you realise you fractured your skull when you fracture your skull?
I didn't, because I'd hurt my head and I got a bit of a headache, they would always take me to A&E just to, you know, for a checkup. And that's when they say, oh yes, there's a crack there, it's a hairline fracture and all this sort of thing. And you know, but you can't, you know, there's not much you can do with it. You know,
Don't go back skiing, I presume, is advice.
Yes, they always kept saying that. Every time you go to the doctor, they say, well, stop doing that. And I go, well, that's not an option. I love it too much. I'll just remember not to make that same mistake again. And you learn from your mistakes.
So let's touch on that point, because that's key. I love it too much, because at the moment I'm listening to you and, I mean, I get it. I get the thrill of skiing and you know, all sporting pursuits in different ways are very exciting. But realistically, I mean, pragmatically, this was a crazy thing to undertake. I mean, in 20 months to go from not having done this at all to doing a 70 and then a 90-metre jump. So, like, explain the love. I mean, was there something missing in your life? Like, did you have no perspective on what the hell you were, the way you were going about things? Like, it just seems like, this is not normal.
No, it's for me, I always wanted to stretch, you know, push my boundaries all the time. I didn't want to stay in my comfort zone. So when I was doing my ski racing, you know, if I skied it in under, you know, 1.5 minutes, I want to do it, you know, 3 or 4 seconds faster and then go up again and do it even faster. And with jumping, it was the same. You know, if I jumped 50 meters, that was okay. I want to jump 55 and then 60 and then 65 and then 70. So I was constantly pushing my boundaries. And that was the most important thing. thing. And, you know, it's amazing what you can achieve if you just keep pushing those boundaries. And I managed to do it. And, you know, never always hoped that I would get to Calgary and, yeah. and always hoped that I'd get off that 120-metre. And eventually I did, and on both counts.
What did family think? What did your parents think?
Well, I always used to tell my mum and dad what I'd done, not what I was going to do. Because I thought that if I tell them what I was going to do, they'd only worry about it. Mm. Whereas if I told them what I'd already done, and they could see that I was still in one piece, so they wouldn't worry. They'd be shocked, but they wouldn't worry about what I was going to do. So I worked on that principle.
These remarkable 20 months, which in many ways are very important, because they... I suppose they put the kind of joke figure thing into perspective. Like, this was a serious undertaking. You graduate up to 70 metres. Are you up to the 90 metres by the end of that 20 months?
Yes, yes. I'd done a few, but not many, because they don't prepare the 90 metre. Now they call it the 120. It's the same jump. Mm. But they don't prepare the big hill very often because they're so big. Mm. They used to only prepare the smaller one, the 70 metre. So you never got a chance to jump on a 90 metre or 120 metre very often. So when I went to Calgary, I'd literally only done about five jumps. Right. Whereas all the other jumpers, because they've been jumping since they were 3 years old, you know, they've done thousands of jumps off the 90 metre, and I've done five.
What about the attitude of the British Olympic Association? As you, so you make the grade for Calgary, it's easier than it might otherwise be because there's no one else really proposing to represent Great Britain. So the British Olympic Association and their attitude to you, you know, on the one hand, you are the living embodiment of the Olympic dream. It's the taking part that counts. You have pushed yourself beyond your own boundaries, and it has not been without huge personal cost, not least to your body. A fractured skull twice, broken your jaw, your collarbone, and you've probably put your life on hold professionally. So, like, a huge endeavour. And on the other hand, the British Olympic Association might look at you and say, this is an embarrassment. This is making a mockery of the whole thing.
Yes, that was a difficult thing, because when I went to Calgary, all of a sudden got to Calgary and they christened me Eddie the Eagle and I got all that attention, and the British Olympic Association thought it was very unwarranted that I shouldn't be getting all this attention. I came 58th. You know, why are you getting more attention than the guy who won the event? And they thought I was making a mock of the sport and bringing the sport into disrepute. And so that's why afterwards they banned me from the Olympic Games and banned me from the Olympic team and the British team, and they brought out the Eddie the Eagle rule. And it was strange. I thought it was quite ironic, because one of the biggest reasons why I became so popular at Calgary was because I was exemplifying that Olympic spirit, mm-hmm. and then I got banned because of it. So it was extremely ironic, but I was gutted at the time because I wanted to carry on. I wanted to use Calgary as a springboard, and then I was hoping to get better and better at the 92, 94, 98 and 2002 Olympics, and then I could have shown the world what Eddie the Eagle and what Great Britain could have produced in the way of ski jumping. I just wasn't given the chance.
That's interesting, because in hindsight, it can look like some kind of pointless publicity stunt. But actually, I mean, they put in the Eddie the Eagle rule for future games, which meant you had to reach a certain standard to take part. So when you arrive and you say they gave you the Eddie the Eagle nickname, that's the press, I presume, who are all over this.
No, it was a group of supporters from an oil company in Calgary. They saw this news item on television about Eddie Edwards, Britain's first jumper coming to Calgary, and they gave me this nickname, Eddie the Eagle. So when I flew into Calgary for the Olympic Games, there was a great big banner on the wall in the airport saying, "Welcome to Calgary, Eddie the Eagle." And I said, "Oh, who's that?" And they said, "It's you." And and then that was it. I got christened it, and it just took on a life of its own, and it exploded into the people's attention, and that was it.
Were teammates supportive and happy to have you there, or resentful?
One or two were quite supportive, but a lot of them didn't like the fact that I was getting all this attention when they said, "I'm better at my sport than he is at his. Why is he getting all this attention? This isn't fair." So, yes, in the movie, you know, some of the people in the British team did not take a very nice liking to me, and that bit was true. Yes, they were quite disgusted by it, really.
There's a text in that says, "Didn't Eddie play a part in the caricature by wearing the oversized glasses?"
That's what they were like back then. You know, that was the style. But they were very thick because I had really bad eyesight, and so one lens was particularly thick. You know, that was just, you know, what I was wearing. But over the years, you know, technology's moved on in the eye industry, and the lenses became thinner and smaller, and so I was able to wear normal glasses as opposed to those big ones. I've still got them. I still wear them occasionally when I go and do speeches.
Right, okay. Were you horrified by all the attention on you, or did you quite think, this is great fun?
Well, I was surprised by it, definitely surprised by it. I didn't think I was going to get anything like that attention. I was hoping to get a bit of attention from the British press, and then I was hoping to turn that attention into sponsorship and make it easier to go to the next, you know, subsequent Olympics.
Yeah.
But I was surprised at the amount of attention I got, and it was great, but then because they banned me from international competition, the only thing left open to me was to go, you know, live the life as a celebrity and travel around the world and open shopping centres and hotels and golf courses and fun rides and you know, earn money that way, because that was the only thing left open to me.
Mm. So you do the 70-metre jump and then relatively late in the day decide, in front of millions and millions of people, I'm going to do the 90-metre jump as well.
Yes, I was always planning to do the 90 right. meter, but the authorities at Calgary were planning to stop me jumping on the 90 because Calgary suffered from high winds, and they thought it was going to be too dangerous for me. But it was dangerous for all the jumpers, not just me. Mm. And so there was that possibility that they were going to ban me from competing. But they had one day where it was clear blue sky, no wind, and they decided, let's just go and do the competition. And I was able to just jump in and do it, because I think if it had been a day later or two, then they might have you know, imposed these rules which would have effectively banned me from taking part.
Mm. I read you landed 14 metres shy of the next worst jump in the 19 metres and 13 metres shy in the 70. How far off the pace is that, and is there any level of, and I'm not asking this, by the way, in an accusatory way, or like you should feel like this, but was there any element of embarrassment?
No, not really, because in the World Cup, when I was doing the World Cup, there was always a competition to get out of last place. And it was usually between me, the Dutch jumper, all the Spanish jumpers, the Hungarians and the Bulgarians, because none of those really were very good at jumping. But when it came to the Olympic Games, all those jumpers, you know, weren't there. There was only one Spanish jumper, and he was their best jumper, and he was the one that came second from last. So, you know, I wasn't embarrassed at all. I was just doing the very best I could with what I had, which wasn't much. In fact, it was nothing. But it didn't stop me doing what I wanted to do and do the very best that I wanted to do.
You end up on the Johnny Carson show?
Yes.
It's kind of hard to believe that happened.
I know. I'd never really seen the show because it was a US show. But between the 90 metre and then the closing ceremonies, there was about a 4-day window. And so they flew me down to LA and I did the Johnny Carson show with Burt Reynolds, which was amazing.
And then you get home. So, I mean, it's insane. I mean, it seems for the following year to 24 months, it is insane. I saw a quote from you. In 1988, I earned something like 700 grand sterling. Yeah, I was earning 10 grand an hour opening shopping centres. The most I earned in one day was 65 grand.
Yeah.
What?
Yes. Yeah, that was it was manic back then in 1988. That 65 grand, I opened a new fun ride for Alton Towers, and then they flew me by helicopter down to Oxford Street in London, and I opened a new sports shop, and then I went to do a woman's own commercial, and then I did an appearance in the nightclub that night. So I earned 65 grand that day, but it was manic, and of course I was working 20 hours a day, and I didn't mind when I was earning 10 grand an hour. Who wouldn't?
No, I'm sure. Like, were you enjoying it? Did you think this was great, or did you feel you were being made a mockery of? Because I'm sure at that point you're realizing that, I guess, but not least as part of these endorsements or whatever, you're playing up to the caricature.
Oh yes, I was. I was always a clown and always having a laugh and having fun. And I just went along with that. And that's what people expected of me, and that's what I did. I regarded it just as work. You know, that being a celebrity, I wasn't sure how long it was going to last. Most people thought, well, you know, a couple of years, and then that would be it. I'd die a death. And so I thought, well, I just throw myself into it, work as hard as I can, make as much money as I can, and do as many interesting things as I can. fan, and then wait until it all dies down. The only trouble is it didn't. And, you know, I had great fun. Then I went for the 98 Olympics and went back to America and got some sponsorship and all that kind of thing. But, no, I was never embarrassed by it. I just, you know, took advantage of the situation because there was nothing else left open to me.
Yeah. Very sadly, I'm sure, like, because, I mean, that's a huge amount of money in at that time. I saw by 1992 you declared bankruptcy. Something must have went badly awry there.
Well, all the money that I was earning was going into a trust because I was still an amateur sportsman and I still had, you know, dreams of going for another Olympics.
Yeah.
And so all the money that I was earning was going into a trust. And the trustees looked after my trust fund very badly and they didn't leave enough money in there for the tax man. And so I went bankrupt and then I sued my trustees for mismanagement and negligence. And then I managed to get some of my money back. So, yeah, there was I was putting it all away for, you know, putting it all away for a rainy day. And yeah. It all disappeared, unfortunately. I should have spent it on sex, drugs and rock and roll.
What does feeling bankrupt, what does that feel like? I mean, that was horrific.
Yeah, that was horrible. And that was the worst time of my life, really. Because everybody thought, oh, you know, here he was a failure at ski jumping and now he's a failure with money and all this sort of thing. So, yeah, it was very difficult. It was very hard to take.
How do you find out it's all gone? I mean, who says, by the way, all that money you made, yeah, that's gone?
It was a meeting with my trustees.
Right.
I was hoping to do, you know, buy a house and things like that with it. And they said, oh, sorry, there's no money left. And it was just because they lent money to friends and family and all that kind of thing without, you know, sorting out whether it was a loan or a gift and all that kind of thing. And then there was no money left for to pay the tax man. And it was all kinds of things like that, really, that went on. And I had to go bankrupt, and then it was not a very nice time. But
yeah,
you know, you
imagine.
Learn from that, and I you know, picked myself up and carried on.
Did I read correctly that the subsequent legal case piqued your interest in the law, and you actually undertook a law degree?
That's right. That's right. It was very interesting how my lawyers and barristers put my case together. So when I finished jumping in 97, beginning of 98, I then went back to school and I studied law and I did my law degree and things. And I loved it. I loved studying law. I loved being a student. It was great.
And did you think about practicing law?
I did, but the only trouble was that the next stage was going to cost me £20,000, you know, to do my legal practice course or to do my bar exams. And I still enjoyed the PR work, and I didn't want to give that up. And with law, it's kind of all or nothing. So I went back to being a plasterer and then doing PR work, you know, as a bonus, really.
Okay. So it sounds like 30 years on, you reflect on it with no regrets. And I mean, it's kind of transformed your life in many ways and afforded you opportunities you would never have had, and it's amazing how it's all endured.
Oh, it's been amazing. I never, you know, I pinch myself now that 30 years later, and yet I'm busier now than I've ever been, mainly because of the film. But it's been fantastic. But it was such a strong message as well. You know, I must have inspired a lot of people back then 30 years ago. And now the movie, it's inspired a lot of younger people. You know, the tenacity and resilience that I used to achieve my dream and things. And I still, you know, enjoy going out there and telling the message and talking about my life. And if I can inspire other people to get out there and live their dreams, then I'll keep doing it.
I presume you're not still going down ski slopes?
I still ski, but I jumped in December a little bit on a 40 metre for a video, but haven't really done any jumping for 20 years.
Yeah, probably not a bad move.
Oh, I wouldn't mind. I'd love to have a go at jumping. I'd love to have a go on the 9th.
Ah, gone. It's a pity. I will update you on what's going on in Paris, which is not very much, 45 minutes in. It's PSG 0, Real Madrid 0. Real Madrid obviously leading 3-1 on aggregate, and at Anfield, the latest score I have for you is 0-0 as well. In fact, it's just gone half-time at Anfield, although Liverpool very much on top. Bunch of chances created so far. Sadio Mane has hit the post after a James Milner cross, and that's about the height of it in terms of coming close to scoring, but they're fighting it up, so frankly it's not a hugely significant issue for them. Salah is on the bench for Liverpool. So text in, Eddie's a star. I saw him on Countryfile on the BBC recently. Comes across like a real gentleman. The fact he did his best is all that matters. The press used him, seems like he used them too. Fair play to the underdogs. Anthony in Dublin, Eddie the Eagle sounds like a life well lived, says Michael. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't familiar with the number of aspects of his story. Certainly the 20 months to get there was no joke. It wasn't like he just wandered in and they let him in. I'm not sure we're going to get him back. It's not looking good. No? I think that may be it. I mean, we were pretty much done anyway. So I'll say my thanks to Eddie the Eagle, who can't hear my thanks, and we'll podcast that full interview and we'll take a short break.